John, Community Design Chapter, you're up.
Thank you. Good morning. Could we get the presentation up on the screen, please?
And John, before we do that, just I know the secretary gave some statistics and data. I know that you all were taking good notes of that, and it's recorded. Can we just make sure that there was reference to economic statistics and acreage and things like that, just so that they're consistent with what's in our plan?
Sure.
You know,
yep.
Just so there's some coordination there. Thank you.
Thank you, farmers, for coming out, by the way. Thank you.
And representatives.
And yes.
I knew that. That young lady is always prepared. She's in charge of two things, jump drives and agri-foods.
Did you get the idea of how forced us into farming?
The economy? Yeah, no, I mean, that's important to the economy, that's for sure.
You didn't get that idea.
Yeah, I know that it's important.
Baxter, you have a good day.
You take care, Mr. Baxter.
As we have a second,
Look who shows up.
There you go.
It's Janelle. It's Janelle.
We have a second. I just want to let everybody know I just received a text from my son. It says freedom.
Presentation.
That means he's done with his first year at the Naval Academy.
That's great.
Congratulations.
I think that's what that means.
Freedom.
He's coming home today. There you go.
Got to go get him. You got enough freedom to go get him?
My wife is over getting him right now. I would like to be there, but I'm right here.
He was forced to be here.
Nah, we want to be here.
He's here to take care of farmland.
He was here just so he could help force that.
Well, it's an important conversation to have.
It is
very, very critical to have.
And maybe we'll get some solution.
We will.
I don't know why the farmers couldn't come back and say something.
I think we should wait for Mike.
You want to wait a minute? There's three of us.
See if he's out here or just using the break.
There are three of us.
What do you got to start with?
We're going to review the comments received from last week's meeting.
We'll just go ahead. We'll move forward. Yep.
We are ahead of a schedule.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
All right. So good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Reviewing comments that we had last week on both the conservation and community design chapter, we had presented a couple of suggestions and received some feedback. So what you're seeing on the screen here is an edit to the strategy 5.1.1.3 in the conservation chapter where we added height. The goal here was the county is going to consider establishing a minimum buffer distance for all new development, which would be increased based on proximity of adjacent uses or intensive use. The county asked that we add the word height as one of those factors as well, so that has now been made part of this strategy. New strategy 5.1.4.6, consider options to better track the amount of open space and natural resource areas preserved on an annual basis. This moves away from trying to measure things in an acreage perspective. It's just more of an open-ended strategy that allows us to measure it in a way that would be appropriate. New strategy for objective 5.1.1, that objective talks about encouraging development practices and regulations that support natural resource protection. The strategy states, consider creating an ordinance designed to protect established, mature, healthy trees during the construction of new developments to better preserve existing trees and green space. That was slightly modified after last week's meeting to not just be specific to residential and mixed-use developments, but any new development. County code talks about conservation zones. These are areas of land extending landward from the mean high water line of tidal water bodies. The strategy states that the county code would be reviewed to determine improvements to the requirements and locations of the conservation zone.
I thought we were removing tidal from our...
That is not part of the strategy. That's how it's described in the code.
Okay.
Objective 5.1.5, explore new funding mechanisms for conservation. The strategy states, consider strategies including deeded acquisition and preservation easements as an approach to permanently preserve the county's open space. The old strategy 5.3.1.4 talks about evaluating the effectiveness of the county's 50-foot buffer requirement for tidal wetlands. This has been streamlined to state, identify an appropriate range of wetland buffer distances based on location and context. We added a little bit of information last week that talked about how the distance varies depending on whether that protection would be considered adequate versus optimal. Moving forward for goal 5.3, we talked about protecting surface water and drinking water quality. Strategies added include explore opportunities to better support waterway management. And strategy 9, work with landowners and agencies to determine additional protections of recognized and significant natural resources like Great Marsh. Were there any comments on those edits? Okay. Moving forward into community design, updated goal 12.3, we wanted to clarify what we meant, and the goal now states improve the quality and character of existing development. Goal 12.2, which states maintain the quality and character of new development, has edits to the first couple of objectives. That includes promote more flexibility in design. We removed the word more, and have also removed the reference to residential plan communities and just refer to new developments. For objective 12.5, we also removed the word more, and this is now consistent with the housing objective 8.2.6. For goal 12.1.1, consider whether the design of new development fits the character of existing neighborhoods. The second strategy, we removed consider revisiting and changed it to revisit height limits in the code. This is now consistent with future land use strategy 4.4.1.2. Again, for strategy 12.1.3.1, we removed the words consider revisiting and changed it to revisit county code. Similar for 12.1.4.2, revisit county code. And also removed the reference to emergency access. We just wanted to talk about encouraging interconnectivity between residential developments. Objective 12.2.1, promote flexibility in design and character of new development. The strategy has been revised to talk about revisit county code to determine if modifications can be made to the review and approval process for new developments that in turn promote better design and character of the community. Removed objective 4 and the first strategy from that objective. It talked about architectural elements in the design. Strategy 12.2.5.1 reviewed the zoning code to determine if modifications are needed to permit new styles of housing such as tiny house construction and agri-hood developments to be developed as the in the code as they appear. New strategies for review. We talked about this a little bit last week. Continue to offer flexibility in design standards for larger developments in exchange for higher density construction. The comment is there an opportunity to be a little more specific about what is being incentivized? The goals for incentivizing this would be allowing flexibility doesn't really provide guidance to developers regarding the county's vision for new development without additional context. So if we're considering ways to incentivize flexibility in standards for large developments, are we being specific in terms of what we're asking for? The first strategy, or I'm sorry, strategy 2 talks about incentivizing master planning.
But John, coming to master planning, why don't we require, consider ways to require the flexibility in design and stuff. In other words, we ought to have trails, pedestrian paths, roads, not as an incentive, but basically it's a requirement. If, especially if we're doing this large scale master planning,
That's got to be a component, not and or if or what to do de da.
Yeah, a lot of communities with subdivision and land development ordinances require those kinds of things, but then wind up waiving them.
To make a superior living environment, that it's required.
Sure, but a lot of developers argue that it's costly or it's not desired, or they can do things better, faster, cheaper.
Government
tends to waive those requirements. So creating incentives for those things to be put into place might offer a different alternative as opposed to just having a requirement.
Yeah, I like requiring.
I don't like the word incentivize without a definition. You know, I mean,
right.
So I don't know what that means.
That's why we're asking, is there an opportunity to be more specific about why this would be incentivized and how it would help the county achieve its vision? We're talking about being specific in terms of what you're asking the developers to consider as part of meeting the vision of the county and then holding them to that. So
I just go back to, I think it should be required.
Well, it's just two great words. Consider is kind of, right, kind of, sort of, and then incentive. I mean, again, there's two, I think consider requirement doesn't mean that it's going to be required. You're considering it, right? So I think, to George's point, I mean, you have two words there that are kind of gray, right? So, I mean, if you have the one gray, that kind of satisfies the other one.
50%.
Right?
Improvement.
Just a thought.
Yeah, part of it, I think, would be tied to identifying ways that the county would kind of push its vision down into these specific elements of the plan so that the things in the plan are consistent to helping it achieve its vision, but also being a little specific with regard to what you're asking developers to include as part of new development and holding them to that. So it could be kind of a two-pronged approach, and we'd be happy to apply some specific language that would then be part of the plan.
So you'll come back with some other
Yeah,
language.
We can do that.
I think the big word is master plan, right? I mean, that's
one of the tools.
Yeah, I think that, you know, we got to, I think there's only certain areas today that need master planning, and to identify them and then say, what do we want in that master plan, right? Because you got to have so much mass to really master plan, and you're not going to master plan a
5 acres.
Yeah. 10-acre parcel, and I think in the encouraging to master plan will certainly pay benefits down the road. You know, I'd rather see one entrance than six, and but I don't know how to weave that into require master planning. I'd like it, but I don't know how that works.
Vince, on the RPC, and there a minimum acreage?
There is, yes.
Okay, why don't we, master planning is required when you have a minimum acreage of X and you have to have these things in it.
No, it's required if you have an RP, if right. you're going for an RPC. Right. There's a minimum acreage, it's 40.
40. Mm-hmm.
Right. So you're required if you're asking for an RPC, but you're not required if you're not asking for an RPC.
But we ought to just say at 40 acres, master planning is required. Anytime we have a 40-acre subdivision, a 40-acre development, a 40-acre whatever, we ought to say master planning comes into play.
I don't know what master planning means.
Well, we got to define.
I guess my question would be, though, so if you have 40 acres and you're doing an RPC, that RPC is the master plan for that 40 acres.
We have to combine the word master planning and RPC somehow, right?
So that means you just have to want to approve RPCs so they get master planning. That's all.
What I'm just saying, I just think it's required. At
I guess
acres,
my question
minimum
would be,
acres of some sort.
Mr. Cole would be like, so if you're doing a 41 acre RPC, mm-hmm. you've planned that 41 acres, so you're not adding anything to what you're already required to do right. by designing the RPC. I think what you're saying is beyond that 40 acres. You know,
I mean, the next parcel who's not owned by the same people.
Yeah.
Then you okay at 40 acres, you need to participate in any master planning for future master planning, because they don't all come in at the same time. We know that.
Right, and there are different owners, different engineers.
One gets in there, then the next time it spurs, it sets a precedent for the others. So how do we link this one this year, and 5 years from now, we make them connect? So I don't know, how do you do that?
Well, I guess what happens is, as you work with landowners, there's an expectation that if they're going to be selling their property, you would look at the surrounding area and try to have standards that would provide, I guess, consistencies, so that you're not disrupting the environment of what's the built environment is what I'm referring to, not the natural environment, but disrupting the consistency and the expectation of how these developments occur. We talked about a little bit of this when we were doing the future land use plan and partly in community design, where the annexation areas are those opportunities where if you're extending some of those current communities out past those existing municipal boundaries, is the type of development a drastic departure from what already exists? Is it going to create conflict? Is it going to be something that would be taking away from what's already there? So you need to have kind of a forward, big picture looking approach as the county, because a lot of these smaller areas, communities, and developments are only looking at the site that they're on. They're not looking at what happens right around them, and I think the county has maybe an obligation to consider the larger impact and how to make it work in a better way.
Well, couldn't we impose certain requirements on the first, say, master planned community, RPC, that would assist in the development? We don't want to force these people to develop their land. We'd love to keep it empty as long as possible because they don't need services, those people. Anyway, so, but as development then continues, we need to require the first guy, like we do with sewer. We oversized, or we do this, or some interconnectivity, or there's got to be, like, if they have any trails, maybe there enters, you know, the trails need to kind of stop at the property line, so the next community we could say, okay, it's a puzzle. We can fit it all together. So I don't know. You know what I'm trying to say?
Yeah, just no, say I do. Like,
the first guy comes in, we got to have some requirements so that we can get to the master plan, IG.
But I think there's only certain areas that would qualify for
that. For a master plan. But how about a small one? Or how about just this RPC and then the next RPC and the next RPC, and before you know, you got if 40 acres is the minimum, you know, and you're an area that can put these puzzles together, or even if it's less, even if you had 20 acres, you know, there may be a desirability to try to make this all connect.
Yeah, but I don't know how to answer this. I'm looking at you guys, right? But the, you know, I think around the Milford Hospital, if there's ever a place for a master plan, there it is. I think 24. I think there's a place, and I think 54 and 20 would be another one that if we don't get a hold of the area as a bubble, we're going to have a whole bunch of 300-acre parcels peeled off with one entrance per parcel, and it would just be wonderful to. But I don't know how to do that because we don't own the land. I mean, how do you master plan somebody else's land?
Well, you're essentially establishing design standards for the development that would occur on that parcel. You're not taking anything away with regard to the number of dwelling units. You're not taking anything away with regard to density, but the interconnectivity of those parcels, the orientation of the building and the lots on that parcel and how they're divided. When that parcel develops, it immediately puts pressure on the parcels adjacent to it for future development in general terms. So, if you're orienting the development on that parcel to be of a certain way, you want to kind of look and see where the next development might be and how you would maybe connect the two or create more of a consistency so that as you're traveling through the area and you go from one spot to the next, you're not seeing this dramatic departure or disconnectiveness between the two of them. They would be more cohesive and they would be more compatible and complement one another.
Do you get buy-in? Do you have to get buy-in from everybody to do that?
Well, if it's in your standards that say this is the kind of things that we're looking for in our new development, they would then follow the standards. There would be expectation, and then the next person along the way would understand that they would kind of have to follow suit.
Because, you know, I think for, you know, for good or evil, the Gill's Neck Road started at, you know, when I was a kid at Wolf Point, and they were big lots, single family homes, and they moved to, you know, I think it was strategically done pretty well all the way to now Governors and then a shopping center. I mean, that area kind of evolved into a master planned road, but that was all one owner, and he kind of had that thought out, and that's what he did, and I think he achieved it. I don't know how you do it with multiple owners.
Yeah, the owner has an an interest in maximizing the value of their property when they develop it. However, there are standards that are kind of part of that that are applied, and sometimes those standards are modified or waived based on the request.
Would there be different standards inside of a certain bubble?
You can change them based on the kind of development that would be proposed, the location of that development. Some standards might be enforced more strongly if you see a large impact, for example, on the surrounding area if the standards are not applied forcefully. But you have the standards in your code. You're allowed to use them. It's a decision that you can make when an application comes before you, decide whether or not you want to see things happen a little differently so that the future impacts aren't so great.
Give me an example of that.
An application arrives. It has a proposed development that maybe isolates how the community would exist within the fabric of the surrounding areas of the county. There may be limitations in terms of mobility and access, even for emergency access. There may be limitations with regard to connectivity to local destinations. You're putting the burden on one of the major roadways. You're kind of seeing opportunities as things are being pulled together that would maybe create adjustments in terms of where the entrance is for that development, the siting of the buildings on that development, where the natural resources are in relation to that development, where local trails are. And you can maybe nudge some things around to make it a little more compatible, but then also something that could work with the property next door should that development then go forward at a future date. So you're taking that bigger picture approach to looking how one application can really fit within that area.
But I think that's where you get blowback, right? Is that you try and nudge stuff around, and that's, you're looking at for a planning purpose site plan change that the developer says, I don't want to do that, right? So then your master plan concept just, you know, it failed, right?
If the developer and the property owner are aware of what's required of them before they begin the process, because of what's stated in the county code and what the vision of the council and the vision of the Planning and Zoning Commission have put out there as part of this plan, and you point to the plan and say, this is what we want going forward, then you shouldn't have to nudge, because they would then come to you with an application that would then meet those design standards, and they wouldn't be asking for waivers on the things that are important to that vision.
Okay. Wait one sec. So the bubble idea of a master plan, is that, are you saying to incorporate that into the comp plan in certain areas, or are you saying it's
master
all
planning
of the areas?
Master planning is good for very large tracts. It's good for areas that have a lot of competing interests. It's good for areas that have a lot of development pressure, and you're going to see an opportunity to maybe work with a variety of stakeholders in creating a space that would be appropriate for, as you mentioned, Bay Health or 24, or one of these larger areas. But when it comes to individual landowners with individual development applications, there's still an opportunity for you maybe to look at how those things come together on that parcel in a better way, and it doesn't have to be master planned. It can be just looking at what's in your code, looking what how your standards are set up, and applying that at a very small level.
Well, is there something like maybe require master planning for large tracts, especially when they're contiguous to other large tracts, or something like that? Because it's not only infrastructure, but it could be an environmental issue that you want to continue, you know, through a number of subdivision stuff. So I don't know. I don't like the word still incentivized too much, but I think that we, to get this vision, like you said, when somebody comes in, a developer, they read our plan. It doesn't, it actually specifies what we're looking for. And they will do that. You're right. They know what we want. The local guys know what we want. They know what we like to hear, or whoever's up here, and they will bring some, plans that they don't want to change them. They want to come in with something that gets approved and moved along. So they will accommodate our concerns, but I think incentivizing.
I don't know where the concerns are documented.
The what?
Where are the concerns documented?
That's what John's saying. We need to get them in here, because I don't know if there's concerns like the current plan, in the 08 plan, it's not documented. And so, whether it's the commission or you all or staff, there's not necessarily language you can point to from 08 and say, well, see, it says in our plan that you're supposed to X, Y, and Z, to give sort of a roadmap to folks and also give some, support for what the county staff might be saying early on in the process.
Mm-hmm. So, have we had the conversations with our developers and builders? In reference to, and here's why I asked that question, because their clientele, right, is by and large our clientele. So if we're all listening to the clientele, the people, it would make sense that this would be an easy process, right? Because ultimately they know what's driving the market, and we're trying to plan, right? And we're all trying to serve that same group of people. So to me, it would make sense to ensure that we include them in the conversation because as my background, a realtor and sitting in new home communities, right, listening to developers, listening to builders, and also listening to the people who desire to live in these places, you're tuned in to what the needs are. So if we're excluding them from this conversation, right, I don't know if that makes any sense. I'm just wondering how have we, number one, And if not, how do we include them in the conversation?
We worked on a plan in Pennsylvania that had the same conversation that we're having here, and it happens a lot all over the country, where there is a disconnect between what happens within the plan and what developers are building, and people who are the decision makers in the government are dealing with these competing interests. I'm not trying to take anything away from what's happening at a market level. That the market kind of dictates a lot of times the price of homes, the type of homeowners that you're attracting, the places that people want to live in, all that kind of stuff. So what I'm suggesting is how these communities are assembled and how they function and their effect on the surrounding environment, whether it's the adjacent neighborhood or a park or a forest or a farm. There's where there's an opportunity to apply standards. And when we finish the plan, one of the strategies that you could maybe consider as part of its implementation is setting up maybe a workshop with the major developers in the area to kind of have that dialogue, to sit down over the course of a day or once a day every couple of months to kind of like build awareness and an understanding and expectations so that they know what's important. They may not know what's happened with all of our conversations here over the last several months, and just continue to build the same thing. But if we're seeing things go in that are contradictory to what the vision is, there's an opportunity to maybe say, okay, let's sit down and have just a developer workshop or a roadshow or a vision session to kind of explain where we want to go from here and what we're going to expect from them when they come to us with an application, and they'll try to meet it.
Is that all done in here, or is it done by ordinance down the road?
It could be a strategy.
Both, I would say. I would say it's in the text, Mr. Vincent, of the plan that gives, sort of a vision for what the county wants to see in developments, but then also an ordinance. Because we're always going to get, I agree with what John's saying, But we're also always going to get developers, and we've seen them, you know, who are just getting them approved and flipping projects, and they're interested in just getting the most lots that they can. So that's why I have to say it has to be both places, and there's got to be as much teeth to it as, you know, and guidance that we can give to staff and the Planning and Zoning Commission we can.
And recently I've seen, it's like, okay, if you want to do this, here's a list of 12 different items. You get it, you have to pick three, and you have to do three out of that list. And then you get, you know, then you know you comply with the requirements. You know, so that's an option to consider as part of an ordinance change.
But again, you know, we just had a secretary here, and we through the secretary, we, you know, was we're communicating that we need to reach the farmers, right, for their input, as George was talking about, and is there an opportunity to make some adjustments and improve upon what we've done. So I'm asking the same thing here with our developers and builder, because people are coming, right, and they're a key part of the process, right, of what we're desiring and also what the community is looking for. So I'm just take the one standard that we just asked of our farmers to be included in the conversation, do the same thing over here with our developers and builders to include them in this conversation to make sure we are on the right track, right, for our planning purposes for those many of thousands of people that are coming.
Yeah, I think that's a good example, because we heard that they were receiving complaints from adjacent neighborhoods that are being affected by the crop spraying and all that kind of stuff. The site plan approval, you would look at where those adjacent uses are and those activities are, and then see if there's a way we could orient the development on that new development parcel in a way that kind of minimizes the outside impact to those homes, and maybe they wouldn't have the complaints as much. You would have a change in terms of the building orientation, the buffer requirement, whatever that looks like. And there could be an opportunity for more compatibility then with that new development in an area that's surrounded by farm uses.
Mm-hmm. So would you suggest that we do these workshops? At what point in the process?
I would do it early in the process, because as you implement the plan, you would then, you know, see these applications start coming in over the next several years that would have more of an impact on the long-term success of it. If you wait, the vision and the council might change, their priorities might be different, the market might have less of a activity with regard to the request for these kinds of development. So I would say if you start soon, when everything's fresh, everything's new, and you're going to start writing your ordinances, as Mr. Robertson said, you could then maybe apply these principles sooner rather than later.
After adoption of the plan, right. You know, not during the plan adoption no. process, because that would hold things up on the plan.
And I would also note that we've had, maybe not in front of County Council, but definitely in front of Planning Commission, we had a number of developers show up at the Planning Commission meetings and the Planning Commission workshops, and I know there were a number of them that showed up at the public workshops, so they have been involved.
Yeah, that's very true.
Okay, so we'll come back with some suggestions. Thank you. Other suggested new strategies, develop community standards for new developments in order to create multiple alternative routes for automobiles and more route options for people on foot and on bicycles. This was added to Objective 12.1.4. This is for citing new developments near communities that are by parks, schools, and libraries. So it's that connectivity issue to minimize the number of trips or distances that people might have to travel to access those destinations.
This is the one you had that graphic on, I think, right?
Correct.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Goal 12.2, Objective 12.2.7, this is new. Revisit county code to determine if modifications are needed to the plan submission procedure. Preliminary conference is mentioned in the code. Before submission of the subdivision plat, the subdivider shall consult with the commission staff. The purpose of these consultations is to assess the subdivider by furnishing information and advice in order to expedite matters for the subdivider, save him unnecessary expense, and promote the best coordination between plans of the subdivider and those of the county and other public agencies. In Part B, the commission staff may require a sketch of the property in question showing the proposed scheme for development of the property and other significant information. So this goes back to the conversation we had last week where an applicant comes before the Planning and Zoning Commission or Council with an idea of what they want, and we ask for more detail. We say, we can't make a decision based on what you're showing us. We need something developed and fleshed out. and we want to see the limits of everything, where everything's located. So they spend a lot of time and money to build that, and then they come back, and then they can get their response. A lot of times anymore, people don't go through that first initial sketch plan effort. They go right to the final one because there's no, you know, request for the sketch. And then because they spent the time and the money, they don't want to change it. So the option here is to say, look, let's stick with having this two-step process. We have something that's very conceptual, and we have an opportunity to provide some initial comments or thoughts on what that looks like before the time and money is spent on providing something that's more detailed. And then when it does come before us and there are requests for changes, they should be minimal, and it would minimize the expense on those changes as well.
I don't like the word sketch. Wouldn't a conceptual drawing or something?
Sure, we can clarify.
Sound a little bit. I can see my kids sketching something.
Well, that's in the code.
It's in the code.
Well, get it out.
But the strategy does say that we're just going to reinforce this preliminary conference step as an integral part of the plan submission procedure. Does anyone have any comments on that?
Is that just to staff? Because you mentioned
I think it applies to everyone. Staff can make comment till the cows come home. But if county council and the Planning and Zoning Commission are not asking for input at that concept level process, and they're only looking at the final expensive site plan that's being put in front of them, there's going to be pushback to suggested changes. So there's an opportunity before it gets to that point for council and the commission to impose its kind of vision on what that final plan would look like.
And it's already in the code?
I don't know how that would work.
Yeah,
you would have four steps then. You'd have, you know, because you'd come to planning and zoning the first time with your sketch, and then your second time with the final, and then the same thing at council, because council may have a different view than...
I think the comment made last week was if staff makes suggested changes the applicant doesn't want to make, then the phone calls are made. And
that's true.
There's a lot of backroom wheeling and dealing. So if it's not done in this kind of like linear process, then there needs to be an opportunity for an applicant to be held to what the county's vision is and what staff or someone else's suggested changes are without the opportunity for them to say, well, I'll just make a phone call and I'll get what I want.
Well, I don't know if that happens or not, but I don't know. I don't know how this step would work. I mean, I'm totally confused.
So right now for a subdivision, it is a requirement that shall meet with staff. So they'll just come in, and again, sometimes they have that preliminary plan that is ready to be submitted. Sometimes they just have an idea, and we just kind of talk it out and go, okay, these are the code requirements.
Okay, but in your scenario, you're saying that would not go there, that would come before planning and zoning?
There is an opportunity, if you would prefer, as staff is looking at these applications, to have a conversation about what is being discussed and what's being presented at a concept level, so that when you get the final site plan, you kind of know what's coming, and you kind of are looking for things that you would want to see in that site plan because it would fit the vision.
I think that looks good on paper, but I don't think that works.
Yeah, so to me it seems like that strategy works, because it says reinforce preliminary conference as an integral step in the plan submission procedure, and I think that's one thing, but figuring out...
That's over in that world, right? That's
well, I don't know. It can be in that world, or it can be, you know, there's any number of ways to do it. I think what John's talking about before the commission, but I agree with you, I don't know that necessarily works that great, because then you're adding a step to the process and you're having a public hearing before the public hearing, and I just know some towns do that, and it's just the wheels start coming off when you start doing that. But there may be a middle ground, you know, where it's staff and one commission member or something like that, you know what I mean, just so that there's some input. But I think that's broad enough that it covers
any options.
Right.
And in that strategy, you're just looking at subdivisions, or you're looking at everything?
Should be looking at everything.
It says plan submission, so the way I'm reading that this would be for everything, because right now it is a code requirement for subdivisions.
Because, you know, part of the rub that I think we all have up here is if somebody comes in with a rezoning without a drawing, right? I mean, what... I want a commercial zone, but I don't want to tell you what I'm doing. And they don't have to, right? They, by law, they don't have. But that's hard to look at what's happening with the land. What are you doing?
Yeah, we've seen applications come in where the site, the parcel is defined on the site plan, but it doesn't show context around it. It doesn't show where that driveway kind of jumps, you know, spills out to show what's across the street or impacts to surrounding properties. I think if we're holding some of these applications to maybe a slightly higher standard to say, you know, my interest is in your parcel as well as what's going on around it, because I have a responsibility to more than just your parcel, that site plan review process may have more meaning.
I like to see what the proposal is. I mean, I know that's wrong, but that's what I think.
In other words, you like to see it all drawn up on a map.
Well, I like, you know, if you're going to put a million square foot mall on a 114 acre parcel, I'd like to know. But you don't have to tell me.
Again, in certain zoning, in the new zoning districts, you're going to have a better idea of what's going to go there. And then with the one, the C4, it will come in with a site plan.
Yeah, but you don't see how the building's going to sit on the lot. You don't see how it's going to work with the name. I mean, you really don't see that.
Don't see much.
And they don't have to sell it unless you get into the C4.
Correct.
So, you gotta put the word
right, so how's the building situated with, as you're saying, with the surrounding area? Does the building sit over here? Does the building sit over here? Does it take up the forest? Does it take? I mean, I don't know.
In some instances, the five of you don't see anything.
Bingo.
Right.
Now that is
going through all whatever
or never. I mean, if it's a commercial site plan review, it doesn't come to the council.
Right.
That's
or a sub.
The purview falls to the planning commission. Yeah.
And I've heard that comment quite often. I don't know if that's something that you have intentions of adjusting. I don't know if that's common in other jurisdictions.
We had this argument years ago because the subdivision approvals and all that were done at planning and zoning, and all we did is the president sat here and signed them. And then we gave the county council seal of approval on something that we had no input into. And it could be a disaster because who knows, whatever, or didn't meet our vision because we're the elected officials. But anyway, we were signing everything with no input. So it was
What happened at that time of that conversation?
We didn't do anything. Nothing happened. I don't think we took any action. But that was a complaint driven by somebody. I won't name the person, but.
Well, and I would say subdivisions are a bit of a different animal legally because those are, you know, state code has said that, you know, they're criteria based. They're not the same as discretionary change in zone or conditional use. So, you know, I hear what you're saying, Mr. Cole, but it's legally a little bit different animal when you're dealing with a subdivision.
I know. I'm just saying, but just should we be looking at it, I think is what the conversation was somewhere along the process.
Well, I mean, to follow up on that, we've many times here, it's, you know, why shouldn't the applicant in some capacity, right? We're making decisions based on what's being presented. And I agree with the IG. I mean, in reference to, you know, you want to know what's going in, right? And we're making decisions based on the presentation, correct? At our public meeting. But yet there's no meat to it, and they don't have to build what they've presented to us. They don't have to. And so I think, you know, this is not a new concept that we've shared for quite some time in reference to why. Why can't they? Why aren't they forced to actually do what they say they're going to do before us? Because our decision is based on that.
Well, I would
and that also creates a disconnect and a lack of trust from the public.
Well, keep in mind that the zoning code is based on zoning, not uses.
I understand.
You know, so what you're deciding, and this is why we went through the new commercial zoning districts, you're deciding that this zoning classification is appropriate, not this specific use. I mean, I know, and but the problem is people always come in with a use. You know, that we see it at the commission, and you see it as well. But you've got to backtrack from that and say, all right, it's not that particular use. It's what used to be 20 some odd. Now it's smaller with the zoning districts we've created. But you know, yeah, it makes it tough. My concern, I guess, would be, is that if council's seeing everything that the commission does, you're creating duplicate processes for everybody. You know, we're changing what Title IX says of the code. I guess
But that's true with everything but subdivisions.
Yeah, no, that is true. But no, well, everything changes on conditional use, but not site plans, because you all are not seeing the 15 site plans we have for right. commercial uses every Thursday, you know.
Yeah. And I think this is where this chapter comes into play. What is the vision of this county for site design, for subdivisions, for new development when it comes in? What are those criteria that you want to see that then they translate and they go into the comprehensive plan, and then they can potentially translate into code requirements that should then end up being the vision that the county has?
Well, I guess we need to revisit our minimum requirements to make sure that those minimum requirements meet a certain level of, you know, if we want superior design, we want all this stuff. Most of these, many of the developers will come in with minimal requirements, and then that's all they're required to do. You know, they walk out of here, they do that. So we got to make sure that these minimal requirements are at a certain level of getting the results that we're chatting about here.
Well, and we talked about this on the future land use, and I think, and also community design. There's a fairly easy fix on that with cluster developments, because those criteria, Mr. Gold, to your point, they're fairly extensive, but they're optional, and we can change literally a sentence, I think, or two in there, and make those not be optional anymore for what superior design means in a cluster subdivision.
If that's what we want, I mean, if we want to,
that's only in a cluster.
No, that's true. That's true. It's kind of, I will state, it's a bit of a shift. You know, because the commission and council in the past has taken the opinion that, you know, a lot of these design criteria should be, you know, market driven, economic driven, and property rights driven. You know, there's sort of been a little bit more hands off on how somebody wants to design what they're doing on their property. You know, but I think from what I'm hearing from council and also at the commission level, that you know, starting to evolve a little bit. You know, we're not dictating how somebody designs their property, but trying to make, looking at how that property works with others around it through interconnectivity and other things.
A more holistic approach.
Yeah.
But I also think that we have been really blessed, because we have some very quality builders, and it could really switch pretty quick, and it could get even worse. I mean, it could. So your minimum idea of more minimum standards,
higher minimum
standard, because I think that you know, you go in other places and the quality is just not the same that we have here.
Okay. Well, in the coastal area, the market demands that, because the clientele
and
is there.
Supplying it.
Right, and they are supplying it, and it does. They're selling the product. So,
but that could shift pretty quick.
Oh, you could. Or if you go over to western side of the county, we could just see them putting in something similar to what we're seeing on the coastal area, and they go over there and they come in with, you know, no sidewalks, no curbs, no, you know, whatever, no streetlights. And
outhouses.
Because the minimums say they don't have it. Yeah. What's that?
Outhouses.
Yeah.
Yeah, those over there, too.
Close to western side and
the downside. We're poor on our side, buddy.
That's why there's so much corn over there.
That's right.
But again, to that point, I mean, it should be somewhat market driven, correct? I mean, the reality is you've got there's certain price points, and if we get too stringent on these requirements, you're not going to meet that sweet spot for, as I've said before, for our local families that we are not serving today, in my opinion. You know, in reference to that affordable housing element, we're not by and large, I think. So I think we have to be cautious. Yes, majority of people on the east, is driving the market in this county, and yes, they are coming here from other areas of our region, and like the walkability and like the sidewalks, and yes, but the reality is it's a little different further west, and we can't put so much requirements on it that we outprice the market need in that area, right? So I'm seeing a nod over there, so that's a good thing.
I would say it absolutely.
It has to be. It's apples and oranges in reference.
You can see the trend, and on another related point to this, when you do put those amenities in, let's just talk sidewalks for a moment. The subdivision or the community owns those, and then are expected to maintain those, which comes at a cost as well.
Right.
Which is added on to just the lot and the house and everything else through
the
fees. So down the road, all of that is part of this discussion, and we're fighting constantly with communities that don't have the funds or don't have the wherewithal to maintain those amenities.
And it probably gets back down to the need to having that workshop, including those builders and developers, because they—that's right. It's—they understand that market.
I don't agree with that. I just think the price point of the property, and when they go in, if like in your subdivision where you live, do you have sidewalks?
Yes.
You do.
Yes.
Okay. I mean, it's built in. It was built in the original cost of the lot. The homeowners associations, the newer communities, or take it all in consideration when they budget everything. It's the older ones possibly that you're talking about that have a problem. But I don't see the newer subdivisions that are creating these HOAs that are in the documents to state how much they're paying and for what are having too much of a problem.
Well,
I'm think the problem is when developer doesn't, he says I'm going to do something and he didn't do it. That's where I've seen more problems because people want the sidewalks.
Yeah.
Want these things because it's safer.
What I was saying is a little different in taking that is the affordability of the amenities, let's call it sidewalks only, because that comes with a cost and each house in that development, it pays an HOA fee.
Right.
I don't know that the HOA fee that my subdivision charges would be maintained in a different area or a different community or a different price point.
Right.
And you just see that variation. And right. Unfortunately,
if you don't require that, your subdivision could have been built without sidewalks because we permitted it and they just made an economic thing. We'll make more money, we'll get the same amount for the house, and we don't have to do the sidewalk. So we'll see them everywhere. So I'm just saying, I'd rather have an appeal process. We have these standards, and then if you know somebody comes in and says, "Hey, look, I'm building this. I'd like to be exempted from this, and give some documentation or reasons or something, maybe possibly."
A couple things. One, sidewalks now is probably not something we'll be dealing with quite as much because when we redid those street standards through Hans's work, we took that from being more of an ad hoc decision by the developer to a design one. So if you're designing a certain type of street, you got to put in sidewalks, or if you're doing another kind, mm-hmm. generalizing. But so it's not, you know, something where it may be in or maybe not, it's coming out or it's going to stay in or whatever. The older ones, Mr. Cole, like you said, we're still sort of dealing with the tail end of those, mm-hmm. but going forward. The other thing to Mr. Lawson's point, and I think Mr. Cole's yours, is the Duke, Iowa, the Delaware Uniform Common Interest Ownership Act creates something, and that's been in effect for maybe 10 years now, right. But we're starting to see it as developments are in existence. They require reserve studies and reserve funds to deal with sidewalks, so there's more budgeting for that than there would have been.
Transparency.
Yeah, you know, so it's not like all of a sudden your sidewalk fails and there's a big one-time assessment. You know, you're supposed to budget, but you have to budget for it.
Right.
So I think we're sort of seeing that go away. But I think everybody's point is that it's not a apples-to-apples comparison because certain price points are going to, you know, have more amenities, obviously, and it costs more to deal with those and maintain them than other places.
So. And clientele want it. And in some cases, others don't.
Yeah, right.
Right?
Right. Yeah.
So,
Mr. Lawson, in your development you live in, the HOA owns the sidewalk?
Yes.
Really?
We have to maintain those. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's standard.
That's the way it is most places.
Yeah. Obviously. Other than the towns.
Yeah.
Like I said, obviously I live in a town.
Right.
And you're responsible for your sidewalk in front of your house.
You're required to put in a sidewalk, mm-hmm. but it's your sidewalk.
And maintain it.
If it tears up, you fix it.
Yeah.
Right. Same with Rehoboth, right?
So, and that was one of the fixes with subdivisions. We were actually seeing some. Really what caused all the, I know we're getting off track, it caused all the problems with drainage swales. You know, you have the pavement, then you have the drainage swale, and in some cases you have the sidewalk literally on somebody's lot that was supposed to be maintained by the HOA but was on a lot. With those new standards, that's eliminated all those problems. So,
I guess the question is this what you, this objective one, what, is that what you want to do? We've talked this thing for a half hour.
Yeah.
Either you do or you don't.
Well, I'll sum it up this way. The strategy is reinforce the preliminary conference as an integral part in the plan submission procedure. That's in code. I mean, so that currently is in the subdivision code now. But I think it's probably good to reinforce it through this strategy because I'm not sure, you know, 10 years ago necessarily that was happening all that much. It was happening, but it was an important part of the process as it needs to be going forward. So I think keeping that strategy in, if you it's broad enough to cover kind of everything we've talked about.
It should be required, I think.
Yeah, it is required in subdivisions.
Should be,
yeah.
but we're not doing everything. Yeah.
Yeah, they're doing it now. Right? They probably
are. Yeah, I think it's a good thing to do. Right, right.
Is it required on both sides of the street?
Sidewalks. I don't know about that. But we're talking about something
else. We're not talking
about reviewing the preliminary plan.
All right, so to continue, we added a second strategy: consider strengthening the staff's recommendation and comment on the preliminary plat. That goes back to what we were talking about, where staff tries to hold an applicant to what's stated in the standards, and the applicant decides to make a phone call. So this is to consider strengthening staff's role in this process. And I think, Mr. Cole, you consider this to be an important thing to include from our last meeting.
Well, another strategy could be is not to give out my phone number. But back to your question.
Mr. Cole's phone number, Mr. Lawson, should appear from now on our county website. Cell number included.
Go ahead, the question again, John. I'm sorry.
No, I mean, is this consistent with what we discussed and okay to include as part of this? This chapter. Okay.
Just there's a typo in there somewhere.
Is there?
Yeah,
on preliminary just references
or on a preliminary plat.
Oh,
yeah, and that's just a subdivision.
I like hearing our staff participate in this whole process.
That's not just on subdivision.
A plat would be a subdivision.
Yeah, but that objective talks just about subdivisions.
That's just subdivisions.
Well, no, I want the staff and our professionals along with the commission. I want them involved. So
T goes to an N. I think it's okay.
But in everything, I don't just want subdivisions because we're not doing very few subdivisions.
It's a preliminary plan, and that can be in many different types of preliminary plans.
Okay, so that catches it all.
Yeah,
as long as it catches it all, right?
T goes to an N.
So it's preliminary plan, not plat.
Thank you. I think we're on to economic development. And this is
you're only 1 minute late. You're doing good.
This is the last chapter that we're going to review that hasn't been looked at yet. I just want to offer a suggestion in terms of how we review it. This is 50 slides, and it's because there's a lot of goals, objectives, and strategies, and there's a lot of information in here that Planning and Zoning Commission felt would be important for inclusion, but lately we've been hearing a lot of pushback with regard to the role of the county and what is actually capable for us to do as a county and what we can implement and kind of like streamlining. So what I was going to suggest is